Welcome back to the History of South Africa podcast with me, your host, Des Latham. Episode 225, in the Greek way of trek from Philippolis near modern-day Kimberley to the Maluti Mountains to a place called No Man's Land. In March 1861, Faku Kangmush of the Amampondo had ceded the territory to the British ostensibly so that Theophilus Shepstone could plant the refugees of the Zulu Civil War there. But the idea was scotched, and the Cape Governor gave the territory over to the Griqua. By the time the great Griqua migration reached what would become Griqualand East, others had begun trickling into this remote and mesmerizing landscape. A highland plateau that straddles the transition between KwaZulu-Natal and the Eastern Cape, hemmed in by the southern Drakensberg. At over 1,600 meters above sea level, winters bite hard here when the frost laces the sandstone ridges and the mornings arrive cloaked in icy mist. Come spring, the veld stirs with a startling vigor. The ground blushes green, and indigenous flora such as Watsonia palansi, or Palans Watsonia, the Diorama ranulci, the fairy bell or harebell, and the fiery Neufophia colensis, the Drakensberg red-hot poker, thrust their blooms skyward. Aloes cling to rocky outcrops, and if you're lucky, you may glimpse the iridescent flash of a malachite sunbird, Nectarinia formosa, feeding on nectar, or hear the distinct call of the ground woodpecker, Geocalyptes olivaceus, echoing from a sandstone cliff. Private gardens in towns like Matatiel and Cedarville are surprisingly lush for a region known more for cattle ranching and cold air. One even features an astonishing collection of South Africa's ancient cycads. If you travel there today, these towns, along with prayer gardens and rambling plots ablaze with heritage roses, are briefly thrown open to the public during the annual Encounter East Griqualand Festival, a sometimes bizarre and always beautiful gathering that combines small-town hospitality with an earnest sort of eccentric celebration of this place's layered history and biodiversity. In the early 1860s, Adam Kok III led his people, 2,000 strong, driving 20,000 head of cattle and other livestock into the unknown. What's often forgotten is that they were leaving behind a land on the cusp of revelation. Within just a few years, diamonds would be discovered there, transforming the region. And Kok, he had sold that land to the Free State government before setting off, trading soil for survival, unaware of the glittering fortune just beneath the surface. This largely forgotten transaction would later sit at the heart of a fierce dispute once diamonds were discovered. Andries Waterboer, one of the last remaining Griqua captains in the Transorangia, would go on to claim that the diamond-rich lands fell within his inherited boundary. The Free State, however, would insist those lands lay within the territory they had lawfully purchased from Adam Kok. But we'll return to that chapter in due course. A tale tangled in claims and counterclaims, where the line between fact and fiction blurs. Like any gripping novel, it has its fair share of cloaks and daggers, frauds and filibusters, half-truths and whole lies. After an arduous few weeks from their farms near Philippolis, Kok's people arrived at Ongeluk's Neck. And you know, if you've listened to the previous podcast, why it was given that name. On the way, they'd passed through land claimed by the Basutu, King Moshoeshoe, around the Hunklip area that's just southeast of Zastron today. The cavalcade rested for many months around Hunklip in Basutu land, writes the Reverend William Dower in his book Annals of the Griqua, published in 1902. That book can be found online at the Library of the University of California, Los Angeles. The Basutu chief was friendly disposed and had agreed to give safe conduct, writes the Reverend. The sight, however, of all this multitude of stock was too great a strain on the goodwill of the Basutus. Stock disappeared rapidly and mysteriously. The Griqua were philosophical about that, saying they were inside Basutu territory, their sheep were eating Basutu grass and drinking Basutu water, so it was only fair that they should have a tasting of the Griqua good mutton. Then began the arduous process of clearing a road down the mountain starting at Ongeluk's Neck. It was no child's play. Every morning, according to the annals, men set about with pick and crowbar, hammer and drills, powder and fuse, to dig out a track down the mountainside. It took weeks for this track to be hacked and blown from the rock, and the 2,000 men, women and children, their dogs and livestock, slid and rolled down the side heading towards a small settlement about 6 kilometers north of where the town of Kokstad is today. Dozens of horses and draft cattle died on the trail, tumbling down the mountain. Their bleached bones could be seen for a decade after this Griqua great trek. Some carts and wagons plunged over the edge, and for years afterwards Basutu harvested the bits of metal in the wagons to smelt tools and weapons. The Griqua had finally, in their minds, arrived at their promised land. Here were rolling hills, the lower Moloti, sweet-tasting river water, springs, green grass. In the ravines there were forests, and the Griqua began to cut down these trees to build their houses, their fur eerst, as they were known. They erected these right alongside the outspanned wagons. There was an attempt at creating streets, but these were neither parallel nor regular, and the houses looked as if they'd fallen by accident. "Like potatoes out of a bag," said the Reverend. Famous Griqua families lived here, the Scots, Turtons, Bowles, Salazar, and other clans. In the centre of this jumble of houses was the main hall of the people, a long, narrow building, 8 feet high, with walls of sod and a roof of thatch, a single door, and openings for windows. No glass. That was a luxury. It served as a citadel, a place of assembly, and a schoolhouse. Next to this hall was an extensive kraal for the town's goats and other livestock. The Griqua knew they may come under attack. The raiders were active in the mountains, the Amatola Khoisan, the mixed people, who were skilled horsemen and accurate shots with their muskets and some with bows. The Griqua built an earthen fort around the central hall, bastions on the corners and loopholes all around. On one side was a powder magazine that was guarded 24/7. They referred to this fort as their lager. Visitors would marvel at this fortress, saying there was nothing like it between Pietermaritzburg and King Williamstown. As their sense of security increased, the Griqua began to spread out across the hills. Each burgher had a farm of 3,000 acres, their Groot Omtrit. Each cost 10 shillings for the title deed, if they chose to take it out, and another £2 per year quit rent. That money could be paid in kind. Cash was in short supply. Each Griqua burgher had to maintain readiness to fight. He had to provide his own horse, his saddle, bridle, powder horn, just like the Boers. If the Veldkornet ordered a general mobilization, a commando, they had to respond immediately, day or night. The land before they arrived was largely unoccupied, but not unclaimed. Faku Kangungush of the Amampondo believed he had a right to at least part of the territory. It lies southeast of the Drakensberg, between the sources of the Umzumvubu and the Umzumkulu rivers. Adam Cook was made Justice of the Peace, and new Cape Governor Sir Philip Wodehouse seems to have taken little or no notice of this burgeoning settlement. "Out of sight, out of mind," said some. The new settlers planted corn and vegetables on the fertile and arable land, much of it free of the stones they had been forced to remove across the Orange River near Philippolis. Game was in abundance, and close behind, lions and leopards, hyena, jackals. These were mostly shot out. They were extinct in the Umzumkulu flats in a few years. Eland could be found, but these too would disappear by 1875. Many Griqua began to complain that the winters were too cold. They were far colder than the Transorangia region. The rains fell in high volumes. These mountains faced the Indian Ocean. The Griqua had come from a land affected by drought and the approach to the Atlantic Ocean. Now they switched sides from west to east, and the east had its challenges. Some said the grass grew too fast, which is odd considering they predominantly owned herds of livestock. Markets were further away. This was a frontier territory. The closest people were the Amakhosa. Durban was 255 kilometres away, Cape Town 1,300. They weren't kidding about the challenges. Many sheep began to die from the wet conditions, and in the winter, huge veld fires swept across the grassy mountainsides, killing more livestock. Things happened too fast. The Griqua style of livestock farming could not cope with the new climate, and in a few months, men of substance were reduced to poverty, writes the Reverend. The Griqua lager they had set up so quickly would be their focus for the next 2 years as clans set off into the countryside to select the large farms that characterised the trekkers and the Griqua. Each farm had to show some sort of preparation, some sort of rough-and-ready building. Some planted rows of crops instead, all in preparation for full-time living. Kok and his Volksraad were left alone by the British to organise their government as a sovereign state, albeit without formal notification. They made several treaties, and as the Reverend Dower says, treaty making was a sort of Griqua hobby, a kind of august royal pastime. Faku and Mushreshwe were those exposed to the hobby along with the Boers. The fledgling Griqualand state began to emerge. Murderers were executed, criminals were tried and convicted, and the Volksraad gathered every 6 months to discuss laws. This elementary form of democracy featured lengthy discussions and very little note-taking. A chief officer was elected, the kaptein, like the Khoi Khoi leaders of old, and the Privy Council or Executive Council was set up. Charles Brisley, a young Englishman, was the secretary, and as he learned to speak and write Dutch, he gained power. But the Volksraad also included a freed slave, Titus Klein. This Volksraad was made up of 24 representatives, 2 from the 12 wards, and they were supposed to maintain control over the finances. It operated as a form of stokvel, where members pay a fee and one member gets to keep the savings every now and again. The only problem is there was virtually no money whatsoever in East Griqualand. All assets were four-footed, sheep, goats, cattle, horses. The cash box of the people, the treasury, was the pasturage of the treasurer's farm, an area known as the government kraal. The banker, joked the residents, was a young Amakosa boy who herded the animals. The Volksraad's decisions would make their way to the Privy Council, a gathering of about 10 men who held their deliberations not in some grand hall, but out on the stoop of the kaptein's house, Adam Cook's house. There, in what was politely called a free and easy style, matters of the day were aired. You could spot the council from a distance, wreathed in tobacco smoke, coffee cups in hand, the air thick with both debate and aroma. But these weren't just procedural meetings, they were pressure valves, a space where grievances were aired, tempers cooled, and as one observer put it, nearly all wounds were healed. It was governance frontier style, informal, aromatic, and oddly effective. The kaptein, Adam Cook, would hold on to his power until he died, and the Volksraad was a wonderful anachronism. Basically, it lasted as long as the coffee lasted, or the tobacco and meat lasted. De praat was gepraat door de mensen die het de praat gepraat. The talk, which was talked by the people who talked the talk, which is a very, very accurate description of politics through the ages. When the meat eventually ran out, the councillors ran out, to use a euphemism. The pots cooking the slaughtered animal were placed near the council house so that the members could watch and smell the progress of their meal being cooked. In the early days, Griqua granddad Piet Draai was regarded as the chef. The meat was done when he said so. His voice would pierce the swirls of tobacco smoke, and he would say, "Kerels, the kos is gaar." Gentlemen, the food is cooked. A stampede of councillors would ensue, the parliamentary dinner energetic, hands-on. There was something both ancient and oddly familiar about this scene. Visitors to the Griqua Assembly said they were reminded of old tales from England, of King Alfred and his court, where great vats of meat simmered for warriors to devour, washed down with tankards of ale. And here, across continents and centuries, the echoes lingered. But this was no rowdy free-for-all. Beneath the surface simplicity, the laughter, the smoke, the communal food, was a recognized and structured form of governance. The Griqua themselves referred to the procedure as de Engelsche maken zo, the English act so. They saw in their own system a mirror of the British constitution, however roughly hewn. What had emerged then was not chaos, but consensus. A rule of order born not from Westminster, but from the meeting of worlds, Khoisan insight, European influence, and the stubborn logic of the land combined to shape a unique political culture, where a man might speak freely with meat in his hand and a vote in his voice. There were a few written logs of a sort at times. In one case, Koos Macherman was accused of not paying his quit rent for years. He defended himself, saying he had no stock, no grain, no money. "You can't take blood from a stone," muttered one of the assembled Raad members. Another member from Onder Zuurberg pointed out that the government should be supported, and a third said that Koos Macherman's daughter had been married the previous week and that her bridal array must have cost several years' quit rent. Besides the ox that was slaughtered, there were apparently oceans of coffee served up as well. Koos was going to lose his farm unless he coughed up. In another case, Hans Beyers laid claim to half in Gailey Forest, which lies east of Kokstad today, but it was discovered that the veld cornet, who laid out the boundaries of Hans Beyers' farm, could neither read nor write. his son Carl had drawn up the certificate, but none of the Raad members could decipher his writing. It was so bad. When they could decipher his writing, his Dutch was worse. It made no sense. So a commission was appointed to examine his claims to the forest. Then came a moment of real tension. One of the men stood and asked plainly, "Why are only Griquas and not the bastards, the apprentices or colonists, appointed as magistrates?" Apprentices were freed slaves. The question hung in the air. A hush settled over the gathering. Men reclining in the smoky atmosphere, pipes in hand, caught between habit and unease. It was a delicate issue, sharp-edged. A question not just of appointments, but of belonging. Of who had the voice, who did not. From the far end, Piet Draai broke the silence.
"Still, Carols, the course is hard."
The room stirred, conversation shifted, and just like that the moment passed, unresolved, but safely tabled for another day. The Griqua, like most other people around South Africa at this time, traded using a complex barter system. Wool, sheep, cattle, horses, goats, skins, timber, eggs, grain, fowls, all were exchanged for firearms, clothing, and groceries. Farmers rolled their wagons into Engeli Forest, that one partly claimed by Hans Beyers, and it would emerge later, wagons laden with hardwoods, yellowwood, red stinkwood, sneezewood. Engeli Forest is now owned by Sappi, which farms eucalyptus, wattle, and pine, but the indigenous hardwoods can apparently still be found in the hills around eastern Kokstad. A horse in these days would set you back around £2.10, equivalent of around £400 today, or 10,000 rand. Cows, even more, sometimes £4 apiece. Sheep went for 10 shillings, around 1,200 rand in today's money. Trek oxen, vital for transport, could fetch a whopping £5 each. Wheat sold at 12 pence for a 200-pound mewed, a traditional measure, while a bucket of mealies cost 6 cents. Eggs, also 6 cents, making them relatively expensive, as they are again today in many parts of the world. Clothing, pots, knives, ploughs, and other imported items cost three times what they did elsewhere, their prices inflated by distance, scarcity, and difficulty of transport. And so, life carried on in East Griqua land. Some were content, others less so. This rugged corner of South Africa, for all its beauty, would remain contested ground, and still is. East Griqua land is disputed due to its historical incorporation and subsequent separation from the Cape Province. The Mzimkulu district, originally part of East Griqua land, was later included in Transkei for political reasons, not logical planning. This has led to claims that East Griqua land is a historical part of both KwaZulu and the Eastern Cape. Just to add complexity, part of the black population of the Mzimkulu district claim closer cultural and historical ties to the AmaZulu than the AmaXhosa. It all goes to show we live within history, not after it. Walking roads laid by those before us, breathing air stirred by their choices. The past isn't behind us, it's beneath our feet and connecting us all. The real irony of the story of the Griqua move east was that they had left behind some of the most valuable land in all of Africa. It was inside their territory, near Philippolis, that diamonds would be discovered only a couple of years after the Griqua Great Trek. Please rate the podcast on your favorite platform. That helps elevate its visibility, and you can head off to desmondlatham.blog. I load updates about various episodes. You can email me from there too. Until next, goodbye.